It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 2014, a number of President Obama's U.S. ambassador appointees were confirmed by the Senate despite their lack of experience as diplomats. Appointees such as Noah Bryson Mamet, the new ambassador of Argentina, have never visited the country where they will be stationed. The Daily Show made light of this issue back in December by playing a series of clips from the Senate confirmation hearings.
How about the guy Obama sending to Argentina? He's probably been there.
Have you been to Argentina?
Senator, I haven't had the opportunity yet to be there. I've traveled pretty extensively around the world, but I haven't yet had a chance.
It's, to be perfectly honest, last on my list.
But surely the guy the administration is sending to Iceland, he's got to be an Icelandaholic.
Mr. Barber, I take it you've been to Iceland?
Sir, I've not had the privilege yet.
Is there a rule that ambassadors can't have set foot in the country they're going to ambassador? Would it ruin the surprise? I mean,
as host John Stewart pointed out, these appointees were big spenders who had donated anywhere from $500,000 to $500,000 to President Obama's campaign chest. And while it's fairly common for presidents to reward campaign donors with ambassadorships, some wonder if the Obama administration has pushed the practice too far. I'm joined now in Studio A by Penn State International Affairs professor and retired U.S. Ambassador Dennis Jett. In his new book, American Ambassadors, The Past, Present, and Future of America's Diplomats, he looks at the various paths to becoming a diplomat. Dennis Jett, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Also with us is Dan Simpson, another former ambassador and Pittsburgh Post-Gazette columnist, to discuss the role of ambassadors in this ever more globalized world. Dan Simpson, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Nice to be here again, Paul.
Dennis Jett, what are the different ways a person can become an ambassador?
Well, there are two basic ways. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that this is not an Obama problem. This is a thing that all presidents have used. It's actually the further back in the past you go, the worse it has been in terms of the number of political appointees.
It's been worse in the past?
Yes. For the last 50 years, it's been roughly 70% career, 30% political appointees. But going back pre-World War II, in fact, in the 19th century, all the ambassadors were basically political appointees. It was very rare. Back in the Civil War, our generals were political appointees rather than career military people. So it wasn't until the late 19th century that we even thought there was a need for professional bureaucrats. And President Garfield, for instance, was assassinated by a man who wanted to be the ambassador to Vienna. And when he didn't get the job, he expressed his displeasure by killing the president. And so that prompted something called the Pendleton Act, which reformed the Foreign Service, and then the Diplomatic Corps wasn't reformed really until 1924, when something called the Rogers Act was passed, that began to that really established the professional Foreign Service, and then gradually the number of career ambassadors grew in number and in percentage, and then around the Eisenhower administration, it stabilized around 70% career, 30% political. So those are the two basic ways. The career people are almost without exception Foreign Service officers, which means they join the State Department at a young age, like Dan and I did, and then gradually work their way up through the ranks in the same way you would become a second lieutenant after graduating from West Point. And then if you were lucky and worked hard, you became a general. So that's the career route for the 70%. On the 30% political side, essentially, you have to contribute to the president's election or reelection. You can do that by bundling contributions. As the main,
is that mentioned. What happened with Dan Rooney, the owner of the Steelers, or the his current CEO of the Steelers?
Yes, his contributions financial were less. I think there were $10,000 or $20,000. That's not big money.
And we're talking about 2008 when President Obama was first running,
right?
And Dan Rooney expressed his support for him and reportedly made donations to the campaign and then was rewarded with an ambassadorship to Ireland.
Right, exactly. And but I think Rooney's contribution was more political than financial. As I said, there are three ways to help get the president elected or reelected. You bundle money or contribute your own. That's the financial. You have some political weight. Carolyn Kennedy, for instance, bestowed the blessing of the Kennedy legacy on Obama, and she's now off in Japan as ambassador. And then there
that's someone whose name comes up a lot when questioning the credentials of people who have been named ambassadors. Is her appointment appropriate in terms of what she knows about that country, in your opinion?
No. In terms of what she knows about the country, obviously she doesn't speak Japanese.
Does the ambassador have to speak the language of the country? Is that a requirement?
No. It's not. And typically, I would think there are very few ambassadors to Japan who have actually spoken Japanese.
Okay, so it's not a requirement. She doesn't speak it, so that's not the problem. Then what is?
Well, it's helpful when you do. The guy going to Argentina that you mentioned earlier doesn't speak Spanish. And so, that's pretty inexcusable. I mean, you can understand in the State Department, if you want to learn Japanese, you're going to spend 2 years doing it. So there are not that many people. What you need, basically, is you need to be able to manage people. You should know something about the country in question. The language helps, but you should know something about the history and
certainly
culture.
The issues that are
– Exactly. And Carolyn Kennedy took to Twitter to complain about how the Japanese were treating dolphins. Apparently, they have some sort of dolphin roundup where some of them are killed for food.
And that's been documented, that whole thing. So that's an issue that – was it impertinent of her to speak out on that?
Yes.
Why?
Because you're an ambassador. You don't get to use social media in the way normal people get to use social media. There was an article – yesterday, in one of the Swiss newspapers, there's a political appointee in Switzerland who is complaining about the lines at the ski lifts in Switzerland, and she did it on her Facebook page. Well, you're an ambassador. You represent the United States. You don't get to complain about, ski lift lines. And if you're to use an obvious and painfully wrong expression, we have bigger fish to fry with Japan than the fate of a few dolphins. Japanese ambassador isn't complaining about how we handle veal calves or chickens or some of the other practices that other countries might find objectionable.
Some would disagree with you on that. I respect what you're saying, but again,
but if you wanted to change the behavior of the Japanese, is shaming them publicly by going on Twitter going to affect in a positive way their behavior? No. There's something – I am not an Asia hand, but there is something called face in Asia where if you publicly embarrass somebody, that's the least productive way to get them to do what you want to do.
You're describing the skill that it takes to be a diplomat that some may not be as attuned to, and this would be one example of that. That's Dennis Jett. He is author of American Ambassadors, the Past, Present and Future of America's Diplomats. And also with us is Dan Simpson, who is also a former U.S. ambassador. We were listening to that clip there, Dan, and John McCain called the way ambassadors are often chosen today, the way ambassadors are basically sold in some cases to big donors of presidential campaigns, as disgraceful. Does he have a point?
I think he does, because in a sense it comes down to selling jobs. These guys know that if they're able to bundle a certain amount of money or come up with a certain amount of money, they get an ambassadorship. And the last time I checked, that could be called selling jobs. The other thing that is a little painful for career people is that these people all go to, for the most part, nice places. You don't read about some political person being sent to Somalia or Liberia or some
countries
place
like you were.
Yeah, like where I was. I don't care because I thought that the places where I was were very interesting, but –
Well, you had several years. You studied at Yale. You worked at the State Department. You worked your way up. Does someone like you, who worked to become an ambassador, Are you offended by some of what you see today?
Yes, but I'm offended not so much as a career officer, because I was happy enough with what I ended up doing. I was ambassador to the Central African Republic and Somalia and the Congo. You know, ask yourself, what on any given day does the American ambassador to Denmark do? Well, you know, the answer to that is not much. So do I resent it more in terms of what the American people getting their money's worth? I mean, when a president sends one of these people to represent the United States in country X, the American people don't get their money's worth, because these guys, for the most part, don't know what they're doing, and they don't represent the United States effectively.
There's a great historic example of that.
So anyway, that makes me a cross.
Sure. I could, and I think many people could see why. If you would like to join the conversation with our guests, former U.S. Ambassadors Dennis Jett and Dan Simpson, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Dennis Jett, are ambassadors still important today? And if so, why?
Well, I think they are. I mean, I think all the problems that we face today are, you can trace back to globalization. If you ask people to define globalization, they often struggle, but it's something that you see mentioned in every newspaper you can pick up. My definition of globalization is people, things, and ideas crossing national boundaries with greater frequency, speed, impact, and reach. And so who heard of Ebola 6 months ago, yet we were getting hysterical about Ebola? And so even the world's only superpower cannot address problems unilaterally. We have to address problems with the cooperation of other countries. And so that requires some skillful diplomacy and not going on Twitter and complaining about dolphins in Japan when there are other issues out there, like, you know, the relations between Japan and China and all kinds of other issues that are far more important. So it takes skillful diplomacy. And as Dan said, you don't get your money's worth when you have somebody who is completely unsuited for the job. And I would agree, as a taxpayer, it's a tremendous waste of money. There was a woman in Luxembourg, for instance, who was so bad and so obnoxious that people were volunteering to shorten their tour in Luxembourg and go to Afghanistan and Baghdad to escape her management style. So that, I mean, that's just not, as anybody who's worked for a bad boss knows, that can make things fairly miserable. But it's also a question of government resources, because every time you move a government employee from one place to another in the world, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars, if not more.
Well, and I mean, this practice goes way back, and you don't need to be on Twitter or Facebook to step in it, as they say. As far back as the 1940s, Joseph P. Kennedy was appointed ambassador to Great Britain. This was a guy that was accused of all kinds of unsavory, if not outright illegal things, and yet he ended up going over there, Dan Simpson, and really making a mess of things, didn't he?
Well, there's another angle to it too, and Kennedy's a good illustration of that. Political appointees are not always exactly in harmony with overall U.S. foreign policy. And at the point that Joe Kennedy was ambassador to U.K., Roosevelt was preparing us for the war, for World War II. And yet his ambassador to U.K. was more or less independently pro-German. So, you know, that's another problem with the political ambassadors. They don't understand that they're part of what one hopes is a coherent overall foreign policy. They're not used to operating in that context.
In other words, you have to be in step with what the U.S. overall global and foreign policy is and attuned to how the U.S. wants you to handle issues with regard to that country, whether it be England or Hungary or
whatever.
Somalia.
Yeah, you should be. You should be. That's part of your job. The other thing I wanted to circle back on was the question of language and your question about is there still a role for ambassadors? Well, I think there is, and it's frequently personal relations and in the less linked countries, personal relationships with even the head of state of the country. And of course, languages are absolutely essential for that. And they enable the ambassador, number one, to have an impact on the leaders of the country, but number two, to be able to interpret the leadership of country X back to Washington based on direct personal experience of, the leadership of the country. And they won't be able to do that if they don't have the language. Now, that's not to say that sometimes we don't get political appointees who do speak the language. I mean, one example was John Huntsman, who was ambassador to China under Obama, although he was a Republican and later became a candidate.
Right.
Yeah. That guy spoke Chinese, and he was ambassador to China. So just think what he could do and think what he couldn't do if he didn't speak the language. And, of course, even one of our ambassadors to Japan, I think, didn't Reischauer speak Japanese? So we have had ambassadors who spoke Chinese, Japanese, Arabic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
talking with former U.S. ambassadors Dan Simpson and Dennis Jett about the political appointees of the Obama administration and how that contrasts with historically how the appointments of ambassadors are made. And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. We'll start with Emmett in Pittsburgh. Emmett, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, guys. Great talk so far.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, and it's really timely because lately I've been thinking about taking the Foreign Service Officer test. So I just happened to have picked the show up. I guess really two questions, and they might be related. The first is, how do we measure effective ambassadorship? And I guess that I don't know if that's tough to answer or not.
Well, no, that's a good question. Let's start there and stay with us, Emmett. Dennis Jett, how do you measure effective ambassadorship?
Well, it's a tough one. First of all, Emmett, thanks for the question, and I encourage you to take the Foreign Service exam. And I'm sure Dan,
me too,
would agree with me. It's a great career. It's very competitive. Getting in, about 20,000 people take the exam each year, and in a normal year they hire 350. But persevere and good luck. Measuring effectiveness is a challenge for government in almost everything it does, and particularly in performance of a managerial role like that of an ambassador. The best way is there's something called the Inspector General in each government agency. It's an internal auditor. And so the State Department has one who goes around, sends a team literally of about 12 people who spend a month in inspecting an embassy in a particular country. And then at the end of that exhaustive process, they write up a very comprehensive report. Back in 2008, a law was passed. They used to classify these reports so they couldn't be revealed to the public. There was no reason for that other than they might cause embarrassment to people. And so 2008, a law was passed saying inspector general's report have to be public. So now you can go to the State Department website, and you can read the inspection report for various embassies. The only problem is that embassies get inspected about once every 8 years, even though the law says it's supposed to be once every 5. So in the very first pages of that inspection report, it will say what the ambassador and the DCM did in terms of their performance in running the embassy. And so that's the best measure, but as I said, it's imperfect because it's delayed and cumbersome. One of the proposals I make in this book, I can't resist making a few recommendations, but trying to be realistic about what's possible, is that we every year, every embassy have an informal, not informal, a survey of the employees via email, and they get to rate the ambassador as they do during these inspections. And then that would give you an indication of where there are morale problems or where there's difficulty, and then you get out a team to look at that immediately. And I think that would be the best way to measure effectiveness. And also to hold that up, there were four ambassadors who, once their inspection reports on their embassies came out, they resigned. There was they were all political appointees, but there was the woman in Luxembourg I mentioned. There was a guy in Malta who thought his job was ambassador to God, so he didn't pay much attention to his embassy. There was a guy in Kenya who thought it was a former general who thought he could treat civilian bureaucrats like boot camp recruits. That didn't work out. And then there was a woman in the Bahamas who never bothered to show up. She preferred living in L.A. to being in the Bahamas. And even when she was in the Bahamas, she didn't go into the office.
It's not easy to be the diplomat in a country that you're not hanging out in. Emmett, did you have a quick follow-up question?
Yeah, the quick follow-up, and that was great. Thank you so much. Kind of the quick follow-up, and I think it's related, is how is conceptually ambassadorship changing, you know, as the State Department's goals are changing? And even globally with, you know, access to the internet and information and social media and things like that.
Good question. Thank you, Emmett. And Dan, do you want to?
Sure. I think that the main change is the change that affects our lives in many, many different ways. And that's the change in communications. I mean, with email and internet and all of that. There was a time, if one goes back to the time of the early days of the United States, communication was by letter that traveled by ship, you know. So if you, I mean, number one, communications between embassies and Washington is totally different, speeded up, much more extensive. And then also the kinds of information that go into an ambassador's assessment of what is going on in a country has changed enormously and will continue to evolve. So it's a different world.
James.
I mean, in all ways, it's a different world.
Oh, most definitely. James in Ross Township, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. James, are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, marvelously. Yes, am I on?
Yes, you are on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. This is a great show. Anything that we could learn about these career Foreign Service people, it's really, really important to get that message out, and I appreciate the show. One of the things that I'd been told long ago was that ambassadors sometimes have to entertain at some considerable expense to themselves, and that was one of the reasons why very wealthy people were chosen for certain spots. Is that true, that they use their own money to provide this entertainment? And if not, is that a burden on the career people if they get the ambassadorship?
Interesting question, James. Dan Simpson?
And it's a factor, but only in very, very few places, which is to say London, Paris, Rome, and so on.
You were
the places
mainly
where
in Africa, so
yeah.
But did you do some entertaining?
A lot.
How did you do that? Did it come out of your own pocket?
The State Department gives one a little bit of money, and the rest of it came out of my pocket and was fully worth it, as far as I was concerned. You know, to be able to entertain people in your home is a means of getting to know them that is there's no replacement for it. So.
So we're talking parties, soirees,
say,
that kind of thing?
Yeah, or small dinners are probably best. But mm-hmm. then the big monster parties are, for example, on the 4th of July, and the State Department will pay for that. So,
Dennis, what were your experiences with that?
Yeah, I would agree. There's something called representational funds, which is official government money given to diplomats to entertain the 4th of July in Lima, Peru. I had 1,000 people in my garden for the 4th of July. And so, the funds covered that. As Dan said, in London and Paris, that's often offered as an excuse because the funds are never enough to cover the cost of entertaining in a capital like that. There have been exactly one career person in Paris and one career person in London, and all the rest have been political appointees. And those two career people, I think both of them complained about the cost of covering the expenses because it's an expensive capital. But Congress is pretty stingy with those funds if they don't like the idea of giving money to diplomats to entertain foreigners. So it's usually never enough. I had a friend who was ambassador in Copenhagen who got tired of listening to the career people complain about a lack of funds. So he pulled out his checkbook and he wrote a check and gave it to the administrative officer and said, I don't want to hear any more complaints.
We're talking with former U.S. ambassadors Dennis Jett and Dan Simpson. Several schools in Pennsylvania focus on international affairs and provide a stepping stone for future diplomats, including your program, Dennis, at Penn State and the Pitt Graduate School for Public and International Affairs. Mm-hmm. What skills and qualities do you see as necessary for diplomats today?
Well, in our program, we call it a professional master's degree program because we're teaching people to go out and get a job after they get our degree, not to continue in academia. And so we emphasize communication skills, both written and oral. I don't give any sort of knowledge exams. All my assignments are written assignments that they have to go and write on a subject and then hand it in, and I grade their writing. In-class presentations, and getting along with people. There's a lot of team work in my classes as well because you're working with and managing people, and that's what it's all about.
And in spite of what we heard at the top of the segment, Dan Simpson with John Stewart playing those clips, which were hilarious from the Senate hearings, is diplomacy, U.S. diplomacy, are our interests being advanced effectively by the new crop of diplomats to date, the political appointees notwithstanding?
It depends. I've worked across a 35-year career. I worked for a number of political ambassadors and a number of career ambassadors. And for me, there was a little bit of mox-nix, probably the worst ambassador I ever worked for was a career ambassador. He ended his career when they told him he could either be prosecuted or quit. He quit.
It's not necessarily someone who takes a more traditional route, that someone who is a political appointee can be effective?
Sure. Less likely, because he hasn't had the preparation. And I would go back to Dennis's point about, it's manage the embassy as well as represent the United States in a foreign country. It's both. And the management part in particular, one learns on the way up. The representation part one does too. But I'll give you a good example of a political ambassador who was enormously successful in representing the United States, Shirley Temple Black, who passed away last year.
Very interesting. We've been talking with former U.S. Senator Dan Simpson and also Dennis Jett, who has a new book out, American Ambassadors, the Past, Present, and Future of America's Diplomats. Gentlemen, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us here in Studio A.
Thank you, Paul.
It's been fun, Paul.
Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris continues her focus on the city's neighborhoods with a look at Allentown. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.